We will. Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank the Security and Stability Advisory Committee for coming to meet with the GAC on this topic. We had an interesting exchange, I think, last time around, and I understand you have some work to report on today, and that you have a presentation to provide. So I will turn over to Patrick Falstrom, who is the chair of the SSAC. Patrick.
Thank you very much, Heather. Patrick Falstrom, chair of SSAC. I'm here to have the, I think it's the second meeting that we have together. I heard positive input from the previous meeting that I had 2 ICANN meetings ago, and apart from having interest from you at GAC to have more meetings with us, also SSAC members have expressed their interest of having more interactions, not only you, of course, but also with other stakeholder groups, just like a report in San Francisco. I would like to just, I was thinking of skipping the introduction of all, every SSAC member, but just because I think it's important to all of you in GAC to be able to reach out in as easy way as possible now when we have a high bandwidth, when we're meeting here in Singapore. I would like to ask the SSAC members that are in the room to stand up, please. Just stand up so everyone, and you can see the ones standing. So these are the ones that you can sort of, can reach out to if you have more questions. Yeah. And the GAC members are standing up, you see who they are as well, so you don't have to talk to them about it. So with that as a short introduction of SSAC, let me go immediately dive into the document SSAC 50 that we released Saturday. We got a question a couple of months ago from GAC, what implications on the security and stability blocking of DNS would have. And based on that document, we wrote this response. And one of the reasons why we didn't say, okay, it is bad or it's not bad, is something that we try to outline in the document, because in reality, next slide, please. In reality, any kind of blocking using DNS is actually an altering of the responses to the domain name system. And that can happen either when the query is on its way to a DNS server or when the response is coming back. It is quite often done by doing some kind of intercept of the DNS query, not in a hostile way, but the DNS protocol itself is built upon a number of queries and responses being sent, where to start with, a client like a laptop in this room is sending a query to a local DNS cache that is like on the local network or at your ISP or in your home router that you have at home, for example. That intermediary is sending the query, is repeating the query and sending it to various other DNS servers in the world. And when you intercept or altering the response from the DNS server, that is normally happening in one of those boxes. So it's not interception of the actual DNS sort of queries on the path. It's actually happening in those cases which have to do with which is there by design. This kind of blocking, altering of the DNS response is something that is happening more and more. And one of the cases where these things happen is, for example, often in the home router or even in the antivirus software that you have in your laptop itself. And this is these are cases that normal people can think that, well, it's probably good if my antivirus software is actually doing something here. But on the other hand, if it is the case that we are doing blocking globally on the internet, everyone understands that that might actually probably have quite a lot of impact. And the difficulty here is, of course, to with the DNS block, with blocking your DNS, just like any kind of technical approach to any kind of like thing you do, there are both benefits and harms. And what we are trying to explain in this document is that when we talk about DNS blocking of DNS, there is a balance to be made, a balance calculation to be made between the benefit and the harm of doing the blocking. Next slide, please. So, another thing that to point out, apart from the difficulty of making a balanced calculation of the benefit versus the harm, one must know that if it is the case that you prevent, for example, resolution of a domain name into an IP address, that doesn't sort of completely prevent the end user from being able to reference or access the information that is available via some protocol to that IP address. Because other domain names than the one that you just used for lookup could be used, or the IP address itself can be used. And this means that if it is the case that you block by preventing the lookup or the translation for domain name to IP address, that will prevent an immediate connection to the name host, but it will not make it impossible to access the information. And that means that if it is the case that the goal of the blocking is to prevent access to information that's referred to using the domain name, using DNS blocking is pretty ineffective. Which basically means if you have a problem to solve, using the DNS as the solution to that problem is probably the wrong solution. If you want to prohibit access, there are other mechanisms that are more effective. So, for example, as I just said, if you have a mapping from one domain name to an IP address and that domain name is blocked, it doesn't stop anyone to allocate another domain name referring to the same IP address, and if people use that domain name, access to the information is okay. It's, of course, doable. Next slide, please. So circumvention is pretty easy. So it's very, very important because of this to when doing the calculation of whether you are going to do something or someone that is in the situation of maybe doing something like DNS blocking, it's very important to think about what the potential collateral damage is and what kind of cost it is compared to the benefit. And the document talk about in general terms that the broader community that some kind of filtering, or in this case blocking of DNS, has, the higher the risk that there will be secondary effects that can be pretty big compared to the fact that the broader impact it has, for example, this blocking, the easier it might be to circumvent. So because on global level it's much easier to, so for example, allocate another domain name in another top level domain or whatever. Use the IP address for the access to the information. And to summarize, if you look at the slide on the screen, the last bullet says that to be able to keep the stability on the internet and enable the security that, for example, DNSSEC and other mechanisms are enabling, it is very important that everyone that is in a situation so they can impose, for example, blocking of DNS, that everyone together make a concerted effort to do no harm to networks and users outside their policy. And once again, the bigger and broader the implications are, the quite often, in most cases, lower effect, higher risk. Next slide, please. So, once again, and this comes back to basically, this is a principle that is used in sort of all the time in the technical community. And when we're looking at various things we do with the DNS and with the internet, is to consider the possible harm. To some degree, that might make us technical people look very conservative because we say no to everything. but on the other hand, the reason why we're doing that is because before we do any kind of change, regardless of what kind of change we do, we are trying to look at very carefully whether what kind of possible harm some kind of change is making. Next slide, please. So, to conclude, if we look at the DNS blocking, it is the case that all technical approaches to DNS blocking will have impact on security and or stability of users and applications, and it do have an impact on the universal resolvability of the namespace. And this is sort of the conclusion of, and this is one of the reasons why anyone that can do blocking has to be very careful of doing these kind of sort of changes to the view of the namespace that the domain name system creates within the organization, inside the organization, or in the area where there is responsibility for the potential blocking. Question?
Sweden, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Patrick, for this very good presentation. I just have one question. You said that the lower the effect, the higher the risk. Do you mean the higher the harm? Could you please just explain that a little bit? I interpreted it like the lower the effect, which means it doesn't really work because you could access the information via an IP address or whatever. But then it's the higher the risk. Could you please explain that once again, please?
Sure. The impact of blocking, if it is the higher up in the namespace or the broader you try to do the blocking on the internet as a whole, the higher the risk that it will impact third parties or the ones that, for example, that you didn't intend to impose the blocking on. Let me phrase it that way. So, for example, it might be the case that if you try to do blocking on a big network scale on the network itself, for example, outside your own apartment, that if you have like your own home router, if it is the case that you do blocking like on an ISP or something, you don't really know whether there is some transit traffic or something which is also affected by the blocking, etc. So both network topology wise but also namespace wise, the more broad the blocking or the impact of your operation has, the higher risk that you might hit third parties, let me put it that way.
Thank you, Patrick. Italy, please.
Thank you. So, I think that the main concern why we are discussing this argument is connected to new GTLDs. And, of course, we would like to know how you see the problem regarding new GTLDs in particular. So we learned that different level of blockings or filtering or whatever are already in place, so they provoke some damage to the global accessibility and in the net. And I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit. Of course, in the GAC will be involved in the evaluation of new GTLDs, and especially in those that, to our opinion, could provoke some negative opinion of different governments. And I wonder if you have been talking about the difficulties of realize a blocking of a TLD in a successful manner. And I wonder if talking too much of this fear of blocking end up encouraging governments that do not like a certain new GTLD to declare that they will block it. And on the other side, of course, the GAC is preoccupied of the collateral effect of this blocking, possibility of blocking, and in these cases could recommend the board just not to approve this kind of registries that could provoke a negative reaction starting from governments. So I would like to have your view looking at these specific cases, and maybe you can elaborate a little bit what has been done in the case of Egypt when the registry, the access to .eg was blocked.
Let me try to explain a little bit on what might happen when, for example, you took the example of a top-level domain, if that is blocked. It is correct that there are some cases where top-level domain is blocked, and there are various views of whether that is actually has an effect, whether it has any impact on stability and resolvability or not. And this is why I'm a little bit careful here, because we are in a gray zone. And if you ask a couple of different people, they might say, if you force them to say black or white, yes or no, they might actually say give different answers. But I think everyone agrees that if it is the case that blocking is happening, that actually means that certain domain names are not resolvable from certain locations on the network. That's what's happening. And given that we are moving towards using more and more cloud services and more services that we ourselves do not really control, it's harder and harder to know what the actual impact is. And we are more and more dependent on global resolvability. If I take a very popular service like Twitter, for example, it's very popular to use a URL shorting service in Twitter which ends with an LY top-level domain for Libya. And that means that even though I am Twittering with other friends in Sweden, if it was the case that the Libyan top-level domain would be blocked, that would impact the ability for me and my friends to Twitter with each other, even though we are doing it in Sweden. Even though we're using a service that is provided by a US organization, etc., etc., etc. So the number of sort of connections here and there, both regarding the network topology and the actual domain names used, is more and more global. And because of that, we want to have more and more global resolvability and global reachability. The other thing has to do with, you mentioned the interest of blocking a top-level domain. And this comes back to what I said about, okay, so the question is then, what is the problem that is to be solved? Is it access to information that is referred to by domain names in that top-level domain, or is it the top-level domain itself as a sensitive string that cannot be used? And it's very important to separate those two problems from each other. And as we point out in the report, and I had in one of the slides, the ability to resolve, for example, a domain name to an IP address just make it harder, absolutely not impossible, to access the information that is referred to with the help of that domain name. So if it is the case that the information that potentially is supposed to be used by a domain name is referred to by a certain domains in a certain top-level domain, I can say that from some point of view, blocking the top-level domain to stop access to that kind of information is not very effective, or different grades of effectiveness. Yeah. And by the way, I am the only one talking here, but if other ESSAC members want to sort of whack me or correct me or come with more proper input, please raise your hands.
Thank you, Patrick. New Zealand, and then the Netherlands.
Actually, I think Patrick has already dealt with my question extremely well, which was going to be, what is the different impact of a top-level domain as opposed to blocking at a lower level of the DNS? And I think that answer covers it very, very completely.
Thank you, New Zealand, Netherlands.
Yes, and thank you, Patrick, and the ESSEC for this report. Although it's very short, I think it gives a couple of new insights for me, at least. And I think one of that is that blocking is in itself not bad or good. I think it depends on the purpose. It depends on the way you implement it. So that's, I think it's a signal which we should take. I mean, we block also in Netherlands. I mean, it's not only you guys who block, but we block also in the Netherlands. One thing which I really cannot grasp yet, and this is, for me, it's not sufficient, to be honest, is what's the kind of... let's say we go out from the good scenario that the ESSEC and others recommend this kind of blocking in the way you say it, with the right techniques, only affecting your own users, do it in a way that it doesn't harm others. Okay, that's a way of doing good blocking, let's say it like this. And I think if countries are doing this, I think it's for their citizens it's good, because they are protected for something which their government or their culture, etc., think it's not good for, let's say it can damage. So I think that's a positive let's say interpretation of and possible implementation of this. On the other side, I think I don't get enough grasp to indicate the kind of the impact, the let's say the volume of harm which it can cause, because you can have one country blocking, you can have 10 countries. And to be honestly, I cannot, as GEC member, say don't. For example, do the ICANN board reject this, because there will be blocking. That will be too. Let's say I can't. I don't have any substance yet to. So one of my answers, or maybe way out, would be, and this is maybe more getting into the sensitive strings, as. Stefano said, because that's basically the reason why we want to know this. What I would say is every application has its own merits, its own risks. And what I would say is that as GEC, we were not experts. We cannot judge the effect of blocking. What I would, maybe it's an idea I would to launch, is that given a certain string which is sensitive, we should ask the ESSEC for a specific advice, what the impact is on the stability security, instead of do it for, in a general matter, without really having real substance on what kind of harm it is. So that's something which I want to put in the group. I think it's important that we think about this also as a GEC. Thank you.
Thank you, Netherlands. Patrick, did you want to comment on that?
Yes, a short comment. It's impossible for ESSEC to say what kind of harm it has as well, a specific string. What we can do, though, is just like we did with this question, if it is the case that you have a specific problem to be solved, we can do a technical evaluation to say whether that problem is solved or not. Because there is some kind, because there is an underlying problem that is to be solved, right? And but without that kind of more specificity in the questions, it's very hard for us to answer.
Thank you, Patrick. I have the European Commission and the United States.
Yes, I'd also like to join those who thanked ESSEC actually for taking the time to produce this report. It's very useful. I have to say, I think it was the Commission who first raised it in June last year in the GAC meeting, actually in another context, which you'll be familiar with. And I found it very useful. I mean, I see the report itself says it provides some, I think, some very useful principles, which how you get third parties to respect the principles is another issue. That's a challenge for all of us, I think. But it says that when these principles are not applied, blocking using the DNS can cause significantly more collateral damage or unintended consequences with no remedy available to affected parties. And I appreciate the explicitness of that advice, actually, because that confirms our view that blocking can cause serious harm. And I have been challenged, saying in the last 9 months on that, saying there's no evidence actually that blocking can cause harm. So I thank you very much for being very explicit in your reply. Just a procedural question. I hope you don't mind me asking this, but it's just an issue that we've had to raise. Did the board at any point ask the ESSAC actually for advice on blocking?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, European Commission, United States.
Thank you very much. I, too, would like to of course, express my appreciation as well for the ESSAC for coming in and taking the time and meeting with us, and for your very helpful report and your responsiveness to our questions. I'm going to follow up, I hope, on what Thomas was raising, because I think this is an issue that we are trying to understand better and get our hands around. It's if we have, you know, it's one thing to understand that certain strings are triggering or may well trigger individual countries to say, this is offensive to me, I'm going to block it. I think what Thomas was getting at, and I hope I understood it because I agree with you, it's something we are trying to get our hands around. How do we best go about trying to understand the cumulative effect of multiple countries seeking to block, whether one string or five strings or 15, because that is a challenge we are going to be faced with as we understand the process. We, like everybody else in the community, is going to be looking at whatever list of proposed strings there is at a given point in time. And so under the agreement that we have now arrived at with the board, there is an early warning system. We have only 60 days to nationally check this list, you know, consult in capitals, and then we come together as a group, we kind of consult as a GAC. There can be an individual country early warning objection, or it can be multiple. So if, for example, one of those early warnings, or two, or five, or 10, potentially do not give rise to the next possible step, which is a consensus GAC advice that suggests strong objection, and the string gets approved, so you have 1, 5, 10 countries saying, I don't like these 5 or 10 strings. I failed in the early warning process. I failed in consensus. I still don't like it. I'm going to block it. So I guess, and Thomas, tell me if I'm like totally crazy and I'm misunderstanding you, is we're trying to understand the, you know, ultimately, how do you measure, at what point does this kind of incremental blocking, I may be using the wrong words, become like absolutely fundamentally damaging? Or is that, are we, you know, not using the right terminology here? I guess we're trying to understand at what, is there a trigger point? Thank you. I better stop there because I'm not going to make sense much longer.
Thank you, United States. Would anyone like to respond from the ESSAC? I can move to the next speaker if you would like a moment to contemplate that. Okay. So I have Sweden next, please.
Thank you very much. Well, I think there are two aspects, and correct me, Patrick, if I'm wrong, because one problem could be actually the technical, I mean, the security and stability and the harm blocking could make on a technical level. I mean, for instance, the use of DNSSEC and other aspects. But there are also, which you also mentioned, Patrick, by bringing up your example about the .ly TLDs, it's like reaching information, and that might cause problems on like the freedom of speech or getting your access to information. So I think you have two kind of problems, and I know that your ESSAC are actually focusing more on the technical things, but on the other hand, in your report you absolutely get the feeling that there might be other more that kind of problems, that is more about reaching information. So is that correct analyze from my side? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sweden. Patrick, would you like to?
First of all, to answer the question from the United States, no, it's impossible to say a number that at when you pause 9, that's too much. Okay. Instead, it has to do with... Well, let me take a step back and say one of the first things that this report is saying is that that using a blocking is first of all probably a tool that doesn't solve the problem you have, and anyone that have the interest of blocking probably have some kind of there is an intent with the blocking itself. The second thing is that there is a difference on the effect is different, and you calculate the effect differently depending on whether the problem and the intent is to, as I said, try to prevent access to information the string is referring to, or whether the intent is to block the use of the string itself, which means that when you put in the effect in this calculation of benefit and harm, you put in different values. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, it might be hard to say, like, if this specific domain name or something is blocked, it has more to do, if this domain name is blocked for this purpose, what is the actual, like, effect and what is the benefit and what is the harm, etc. Then it might be possible to do some kind of estimate, maybe, or something. But anyways, the second thing, to answer what Sweden was pointing out, yes, we are referring not only in the document, not 100% to technical instability. We are also, just like I think all of you, following the discussions, for example, in the Human Rights Council and the work in the IGF regarding freedom of speech and openness and what the Special Rapporteur on freedom of expression is saying. But what we have been looking at from the technical and stability point of view has more to do with the ability for example, an individual to always reach their email server and fetch their email regardless of where they are in the world when traveling, and the ability for a business to get customers all over the world and that kind and what kind of potential technical blockers there are. So that's why we are... That's where sort of our focus lays on doing that kind of calculations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Norway.
Yes, thank you. I also want to give the appreciation of ESSAC being here and share this information with us. So just an observation. So basically what you may be saying is that, of course, the blocking method of that would probably cause less harm would then to block on the protocol level, like on the end-to-end protocol with the deep packet inspection probably, and not use the DNS as a blocking tool, and to just leave the resolvability and have all the domain names being resolved, and then just do this deep packet inspection and block on the protocol level regardless of what end-to-end protocol is used. But of course, so that would be sort of one way to do that, of course.
Thank you, Norway. Did you want to respond to that, Patrick?
What we're saying is that you have to make sure, you should try to make sure that you are using as surgical mechanism as possible to solve the problem that you want to have solved. And what we're saying is that blocking DNS is a pretty bad tool to use for most problems that we at ESSAC have seen to when we have been writing this report. So that's where that's as far as we have gone in the work that we are doing in ESSAC.
Norway.
Yes, thank you. And also, as you pointed out, that of course also the report is about maintaining the universal resolvability for the DNS, and which is also a point in itself. So, yes, thank you.
Thank you, Norway. So, I have a question. I will defer then if the United States Okay. My question was more about what happens next with the work of the ESSAC. So if we're ready to move to that question, please. Egypt, would you like to make a comment first?
Yes. Can I just ask a very quick question before we move to yours? When we say blocking, is this one-to-one with filtering, or is filtering something else that comes later, or?
Patrick?
Well, DNS blocking is one kind of filtering. So the term filtering, from a technical point of view, must be used in a specific context, that you filter traffic, you filter specific application, you filter subset of the whatever commands in an application, you filter part of the DNS lookup. So just filtering is for us, you need to have more context to be able. There are two different terms, so it's hard to really say, to answer your question there.
Thank you, Egypt. UK?
Just a quick question. Can they both have the same effect for a top-level domain, filtering and blocking? Could they serve the same purpose, I guess is the question.
DNS blocking is filtering applied put it on the DNS protocol. You can have other kind of filtering applied to other protocols, including the IP protocol, the mail protocol, and whatever. So you cannot talk about filtering or DNS blocking, because filtering is I think what you mean is with filtering is to block access on an IP level, for example, to certain IP addresses. That might be what you mean with when you say filtering. Is that correct? Okay. Blocking access, blocking on the IP level is something that, of course, has a different effect, much different effect than blocking on the DNS level. This is not something that we have been looking into with ESSAC. Let me just make this clear. So I'm just speaking as an individual here. But it is the case that if you block access on the IP level, that of course makes it impossible to send IP packets to that destination where that IP address is. And that has much different impact than make it impossible to resolve a domain name to an IP address. Okay.
Thank you, Patrick. Okay, so in terms of the work that you're carrying out, what are your next steps?
The next steps, well, the process we have in ESSAC is that we are triggered by some events, and then we might write a document like we did in this case. And when the document is written, it's out there, and we hope that people pick it up. So we don't have any. So the next thing we might do is something else, a follow-up or something, but that needs to be triggered by some kind of event, either internally inside ESSAC or based on, for example, generic feedback or something, like a session like this. Or, for example, that we get direct questions from GAC or other groups, new questions that we have to answer, which then are triggered into other documents. That might be follow-ups that reference this document. But for this document as itself, we are done. So we're not going to do anything else on this now.
Thank you, Patrick. I have United States and Sweden.
Thank you. Perhaps another stupid question, so my apologies, because this is all very confusing and challenging for just a mere bureaucrat. So it's, and I take your point that it's impossible to sort of decide that if you have X number of countries blocking X number of TLDs, that's a problem. That's, you know, you can't set that. Is there a way of monitoring reports or announcements or, you know, assertions, let's say, that X number of TLDs by X number of countries are going to be blocked? mean, is there any mechanism that would make sense in that regard, so that the, you know, at the end of the day, what we're trying to get our hands around is the degree of harm, the scope of the harm, and how you could mitigate it. As you all know, we originally started out way back in 2007 with this idea that one way to mitigate it is just don't go there. You know, don't propose strings that are going to be considered offensive, objectionable, controversial, et cetera, or sensitive. Well, so we lost that battle. So now we're trying to figure out, though, how do you establish markers, if you will, so that we can understand when a certain critical point has been arrived at where this is now truly putting resolvability, security, stability at risk.
Patrick, please.
First of all, it's not, if you look at it from a technical perspective, it's not countries that do the blocking. Okay. So what is happening, we have to remember that there is a chain of events that needs to happen. And what I think you're referring to is that a country is imposing a policy on, for example, the service providers in the country or operating in the country or whatever, under some kind of tools or licensing mechanism, whatever the country is using or the state is using, that forces whoever is running a resolver to do this kind of blocking in the DNS. So we just have to know that distinction. And one of the reasons why the distinction is important is that that is one of the sort of weaknesses with blocking of the top-level domain exists, because depending on how that sort of the state is imposing the blocking, for example, let's say that it is the main ISPs. So what about enterprises that run their own DNS resolver? What about the end users that have their own VPN tunnel out of the country, et cetera? So to a termination point that it outside the jurisdiction of the country. So the distinction there is pretty important. Okay, let's see. I'm sorry, it's late in the day. I don't remember the last part of your question, actually. I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Thank you. No, and this is very challenging for me, so I'm probably not being very clear at all. The idea was, if is there a way to try to monitor, you know, so many numbers of countries blocking so many numbers of strings?
Yeah. So yes, now I remember. Thank you very much for reminding me. There are a number. One thing that we saw when we did this report is that there is a lot of talks that you have heard about as well, that blocking exists out there, certain country codes in some parts of the internet. On the other hand, we found out that it's actually very difficult to get data on that as it is today, because there is today no such monitoring that is sort of covering. What exists, though, is that there are a number of initiatives, for example, one by RIPE NCC to have probes that are in networks here and there. And the RIPE NCC project, which is just one example, there are many out there, I don't even know all of them myself. The RIPE project is called Atlas, where they ask people to put probes out in the network, and those probes are monitoring all the time the quality of the network and resolvability of domain names, etc. One of the issues that I know that RIPE NCC have talked to me about is that deployment of those probes is quite often illegal in those same countries that do the blocking. So to some degree, the monitoring and the blocking to some degree is combined. And this is one of the reasons why it's hard to get the data, because it might be the case that it's difficult to get the data from the areas where you actually would like to have the data. So your answer to answer your question, I would say no. It is all based on individuals reporting, which is not bad, because that's how many other things are reported and data collected in the world. The important thing is that whatever ways you got the data, that you know how it was collected, so you don't draw the wrong conclusions from it.
Thank you for that. I have Sweden and the Netherlands.
Thank you, Heather. Actually, this is Not a question, actually, it's a reflection, because I very, very much appreciate, of course, the presentation of Patrick, but also the interaction that we have now with the ESSEC, with the whole ESSEC group, and actually the work that you've been doing. And one of the things that I think is very important, that I personally think is necessary for us, and for not only for me, for us in the discussions, is actually the interpretation between technical movements or technical actions that have impact the public policy. Because even though you guys are very high level, very good technical persons with a high knowledge, you also, in this report and also in the discussion, you managed to interpret for us what impact technical actions have on public policy, and that is very important for us. But then we suddenly start to understand, and I have, during the discussions today, I had many examples of that interpretation that is very, very valuable for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Sweden. Netherlands, then UK.
Yes, thank you, Chair. We were thinking about follow-up actions. I think Suzanne made a very good remark, and that connects also to the case of XXX. It's not an unfortunate precedent, but it is a precedent. It means that XXX is in the root. We know that many, many countries have problems with XXX. And is there a way in which that specific case can be monitored over the coming half year? I mean, it's in the root, it's available, but there are no, let's say, DNS resolving to the second level. So that I would say, not only to the ESSEC, but probably also to the ICANN board, which could be a signal, watch this very carefully and look whether things are going wrong. Monitor this, please. That's one question. The second one would be maybe that as a follow-up action, ESSEC could try to elaborate a little bit more on the effective ways of implementing blocking if it's strictly necessary. That means that you have proof that blocking is not effective if you do it on a certain, let's say, route way, or the DNS way. On the other side, it's good to, if it's really, if you can't avoid it and you need it in a country, then it should be good practices to block. And how will you do this? How will you do it that, you, let's say, it will only affect your own customers, your own internet users in your own ISPs? Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. I'm sorry, Netherlands. Okay, I have UK and then Italy.
Yes, thanks very much. First of all, appreciate very much the presentation and clarifications and explanations. I just wonder, for a follow-up, whether a little bit more comparison of filtering and blocking could help. You expressed a personal point. I mention it because .XXX has been mentioned, and ICM made several pronouncements that it's not necessary to block .XXX. You know, within a society, if it's desirable to block .XXX, they provide all the means for filtering it out to the equivalent degree. So I just sort of float that as a potential area for consideration. I would be interested to hear a view on that, and for it to be set out in a short paper. Finally, just a very non-technical point. Is the paper available in other languages? Is it English only? Thank you.
Please, Patrick.
No, it's only available in English. Do I take that as a request to have it in other languages?
Yeah, I think it would be a very good idea for it to be in other languages, because this is of interest to the whole global community. Thank you.
Thank you for that, UK. So I have Italy and Egypt, and then I will look to close the speaking order so that we can end the session. Okay, so Italy, please.
Yeah, just I want to provoke a little bit the experience of the SAC, and I'm honored to be one of the members, is such that they could well develop two guidebooks. One guidebook for the information provider that want to avoid blocking of any type, and then try ways to with secondary servers or with whatever is the technology involved, and as we learned to make a very successful 100% blocking is almost impossible or very, very difficult. And then they might instead make a guidebook for governments that would like to make some blocking with some success. Because this is the experienced users, normally they have other means to avoid and to avoid blocking, or just personally with their experience. And on the other side, it was mentioned the case of XXX that is certainly not useful to block, because maybe XXX could spread moderated pornography, but if someone do not want to accept any form of pornography, blocking XXX has no effect at all.
Thank you, Italy. Egypt, please.
I was going to ask a question along what UK has already posed, and whether I understand that blocking, we said, is one way of filtering, but you also mentioned that IP filtering is very different from blocking and have very different effects. So can we say that it affects internally more than its negative effect on the external world, or not necessarily?
Egypt is last in the speaking order, so if you want to respond, Patrick, to some of the questions that have been posed.
Yeah, one thing, I thank you very much for very good questions. And regarding, first of all, the translation, we take that question back. It has to do with, we have translated some of our reports to other languages. For financial reasons, we don't have budget to do with all of them, but this is just 2 pages. And if there is a request, we take this back and see what we can do about that. Then regarding blocking and filtering, we have been looking very specifically at blocking on using the DNS. And both blocking and filtering as terms by themselves are very, very broad. And that's why we talk about DNS blocking. Okay. So every time we in this session have used the term blocking, we actually mean DNS blocking. If we look at it technically, what is then the difference between blocking and filtering? Well, it's two different terms with, like, what's really the difference? Yeah. But now, what you asked here is, is there any difference between doing impact on the DNS protocol and then the IP protocol? And the answer is that depending on what you want to do, the two mechanisms might have different effect, first of all. So you once again have to start with, what is your goal if it is the case that you want to do blocking? Because just saying, I want to block, is not enough. There must be a reason why you want to block. If you want to, as I've taken this example a couple of times, is it the use of the string itself? Is it the string that is sensitive? Or is it the data that you can access with the help of the domain name that you don't want parties to access? Those are two very different things. And depending on which one of the problems, for example, these two problems, and there are more, you want to resolve, there are different ways of solving that problem. Okay. So if you look at, for example, IP address, then blocking compared to DNS blocking, DNS blocking stops the ability of using that domain name. the IP address blocking stops the ability to access things using that IP address. But I think there have been and probably will be quite a lot of large, quite a number of sessions, for example, at the IGF that talk about various ways of doing the, or for example, or and in discussion with law enforcement agencies, what if it is the case that you want to block access to information or prohibit people from accessing information, as we heard Italy saying as well, to make that to be able to do that to 100% is not possible. You need to go there. Literally, you need to go to the host where the information is and turn it off. That's the only effective way of dealing with things.
Egypt? Just a very quick response. I was not looking how successful would it be to address the purpose of the DNS blocking or the IP filtering. I was asking it the other way around, which would be less harmful to the outside world. But again, it's from one side how successful it would be, but this was not really my question. I was...
Now I understand, and that's a really good question. I think just from top of my head directly, but this is a typical thing that could be like a longer investigation to try to answer that question. But I would say I'm looking carefully at Danny that probably will whack me now afterwards if I say the wrong thing here. But I would say that most people say that the lower down in the protocol stack you do the impact on the communication, the more surgical it would be. The more precise it will be. Okay, and notice that I'm not using the term less harm here, more precise. Because if you do impact on the IP address level, if you're unlucky, you might have impact like, for example, the YouTube accident when a routing announcement mistake in Pakistan made YouTube inaccessible in large parts of the world while the domain name lookup actually worked. So what harm it might make is also very difficult to draw conclusions on. So yes, I am ducking. I am not really answering your question, but this is exactly why we cannot answer your original question, yes or no. We have to produce and present to you the algorithm that has to be used when you do the calculation of checks and balances. And by the way, one more thing. Jim, my vice chair of ESSAC, pointed out to me that both the term blocking and filtering are very generic, and both of them are actually used as equivalents of each other. So to some degree, because you need to have a context, what is it you're doing? You're filtering on the DNS protocol, you're filtering the IP address, you're blocking an IP address, you're blocking access to certain IP addresses, you're blocking access to certain domain names. So please, whenever you are using these terms, be a little bit more precise, like when we are saying DNS blocking, for example. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Patrick. So with that, I think we can move to close this discussion. And again, I will thank you. This has been very informative for us, and I think has raised a few questions as well around related issues beyond just DNS blocking. So thank you very much. For GAC members, if you could remain seated, we will ask New Zealand to take us through the work plan for the Framework of Interpretation Country Code Working Group before we have our break. Is that okay, New Zealand?
Yes, thank you, Heather. And I hope this can be dealt with expeditiously because I know we all need to take a break. Basically, the Framework of Interpretation Work Group came out of the work done by let me get the name of it right, the Delegation, Redelegation and Retirement Working Group, which gave a series of reports, I think, to the Cartagena meeting or the one before that, and made specific recommendations about follow-up studies. The Framework of Interpretation Working Group was the first step in terms of working through those recommendations. The recommendation was that, as a first step, the CCNSO Council undertakes the development of a framework of interpretation for the delegation and redelegation of CCTLDs. This framework should provide a clear guide to IANA and the ICANN Board on interpretations of the current policies, guidelines and procedures relating to the delegation and redelegation of CCTLDs. So that's where it came from. Although it's being run by the CCNSO, it is in fact a multi-constituency working group, and where the GAC provided observers for the original delegation, redelegation, retirement working group process, the San Francisco meeting agreed that the GAC would take full participation in the Framework of Interpretation working group. Now, I understand that three members of the GAC put up their hands to actually take part. I was one. I think Bill Dee did on behalf of the EU, and Suzanne from the US. I don't think any of us have actually managed to partake of any of the discussions of so far taken place in terms of that working group.
Not true.
Not true. Not you?
I was on a call.
Oh, my apologies. Right. I certainly wasn't able to do. They've had two calls so far. The working methods are basically that no decisions are made until at least two calls have been taken, so that, and as they move around the clock, so that people who are caught in the middle of the night can take part in another meeting before a decision has taken place. So it takes time to work the way through. Now, this particular document, which was circulated and is available for inspection, I circulated to the GAC along with a document which was the actual set of terms that were going to be discussed. So it was circulated some time ago. I don't believe it is contentious. It is simply a layout of the work plan and the timings, which I'd point out run through to the middle of 2013. And the process is prolonged and the steps are detailed. I undertook to get the endorsement of the GAC to the document while the working group proceeded with its work, so that these things can go on in parallel, and I believe that will be a possibility as we go forward, that we don't want to impede the progress of the working group, but there will be plenty of time for the GAC to comment and for some retrospective changes to be made if necessary. If that is the case here, there is an invitation for us to add or change the document, even though the working group itself has agreed to it and is progressing with it. And I think that's probably enough for me to say at the moment. I'm very happy to answer any questions, at least questions I can answer at this point. I would point out that we can also discuss it when the CCNSO meets with us tomorrow, and there is an open meeting of the working group on Thursday afternoon, I think 3 to 5 o'clock. So I'll leave it there, Heather, and I'm happy to answer any questions
Thank you, New Zealand. Are there any questions about next steps regarding this working group? European Commission.
Yes, thank you, and I apologise. I was also unable to participate in the two calls. Frank, I think you have, however, been able to follow it a bit more closely than me. I haven't. I need to read this paper, but you used the expression that you undertook to get GAC endorsement for document. I wonder, do you have a feeling for the timing on that, given that we haven't discussed it yet, and I guess it's going to be more than one page, this document?
Unfortunately, the document is quite substantial. There are copies available. It was circulated about, I think I circulated it about 2 weeks ago. It is very long, it is very detailed, it actually requires quite careful reading, but it is, in the end, simply a timetable of outlining the work plan. It explicitly says that the working group itself will not look at policies, but will simply be concerned with interpretation. And there's no policy outline within the document itself. So I don't know, in answer to Bill's point about how to proceed, I was rather hoping that this meeting would simply give the tick to the document so we could report on Thursday that the GAC was happy with the document and for the work to proceed as outlined.
Thank you, New Zealand. Did you want to come back on that, European Commission? Okay, and then I have United States.
That's fine. I think, I think I have looked at it, actually, and you're right, it's mostly a timetable of work, and I wouldn't envisage, really, anyone having any problems with that. Endorsement always sounds very formal to me, actually. It sounds as though we're signing up to something. So I think, the absence of any concerns on our part at this stage, actually, and the encouragement for the working group to go forward would be fine, if that's what they're looking for. I think we're not at that stage yet, but the issues of delegation, redelegation, retirement are potentially extremely politically delicate matters. So we should probably avoid at any point endorsing anything without time for a proper discussion and a careful consideration in the GAC. And it sounds to me as though we're not going to probably have an opportunity at this stage to do that, but it also sounds as though we don't need to endorse anything much, just encourage the working group to keep going. Thank you.
Thank you for that, European Commission. United States.
Thank you, and I appreciate Frank's overview and Bill's comments as well as you giving us time, because I know we do need to take a quick break. But just as a quick FYI, I'm participated in one of the two calls as one of your liaisons. So no commentary from me representing the GAC perspective at all. Just being there to understand what their intentions were. That was their very, very first call, and they were reviewing the work plan just to get agreement, and it takes the two calls to do that. As Frank points out, it's quite detailed, but it's got a timeline that scopes out how they will tackle all of the different issues. There was an interesting sentence in there that I would draw your attention to. I don't have it in front of me. My apologies, so I don't know what page it's on. But I think they're trying to be very, very clear about the scope of the work. But there was a sentence that gave me pause because it seemed to suggest that the intention is not to revisit or rewrite existing policy, but to interpret or reinterpret to help interpret what the policy means. And the existing policy documents are RFC 1591 and the GAC principles. So I raised what I hope you will think was a very logical question, which is, does that mean you are not looking to the GAC to revise its principles, or you would not have a problem should the GAC decide it needs to? Because it strikes me that that would be, and they were very careful to say to back off immediately, and they hadn't intended to suggest that they were dictating to the GAC. It is our decision to take should we wish to revisit our 2005 GAC principles and guidelines for CCTLD delegation and redelegation. And I'm just a personal observation, I am guessing we may want to, because there are certain issues, as you go through the timeline, they devote work to specific categories of issues. And there are certain issues like how do we want to define the interests of the local internet community, which I believe our 2005 principles do not address, but that is something that we may want to speak to. So I just wanted to add a little bit more flavor behind that so that we know as we go ahead. I don't think we have to decide anything when we meet with them tomorrow, and I think Bill and Frank are both correct. I don't know that we need to endorse their base document, but just concur that we strongly support this work and intend to work collaboratively with them.
Thank you, United States. I have New Zealand and then UK, and then I think we can conclude this discussion. Norway, then we will conclude. Okay, please, New Zealand.
Yeah, thanks. And th- thanks, Suzanne, for building out. I was abbreviating my comments, and I was going to highlight just exactly what the scope is. The working group is tasked to develop interpretations of policy statements, and as Suzanne has said, the two policy statements have been picked on are ROC 1591 and the GAC principles. Those are the two documents that are used for this. The other source material is the decisions that have been taken by IANA over the existing set of redelegations that have taken place, and those are the source materials for the terms that need to be interpreted. And the scope specifically states any proposal to amend, update, or change the policy statements is outside the scope of this working group. So there's no intention whatsoever of doing that. It's a matter of providing initially a set of definitions for the various terms that have arisen. And I did circulate a second document which outlined what those terms were. That's the initial part of the work plan. Thank you.
Thank you for that. United Kingdom.
Thanks very much. And obviously there's a lot of work going to be involved here by the FOIWG. And I must admit I haven't really focused too much on this at all because of GTLDs, new GTLDs primarily. I think what I hope to enable me and perhaps colleagues who find themselves in a similar position to enable me to get a handle on this is if in a document like this it highlights we will need GAC advice on this issue, this element or something within a time frame, so on. So I can quickly and then I can quickly assess I've got to do some work here. This is to do with the country code. Maybe I have to consult the registry or whatever. And then I know I can start planning ahead to sort of engage with this and contribute where as the GAC rep, I need to contribute and then contribute to a GAC response or input and so on. So that's just my kind of plea, as I say, to help me get a handle on this. I mean, there's a lot of detail in this particular paper within the work plan and so on. If there's some sort of highlighting, we will need GAC input on these, you know, that will, I think, be a great help for me and I'm sure maybe others too. Thanks.
Thank you. UK, Norway.
Thank you. US touched upon this, and of course it would be probably most helpful to have a working group like this interpret the GACs as a TLD policies. But of course the authoritative interpreter would be GAC, of course. But of course then you could have how the community interprets the policies and the principles, and then of course the GAC may then have to revisit and make it clear or to more definitions or whatever. So I think it could be useful, but of course at the end, of course, GAC would be the authoritative interpreter of our own principles. But that could be of course helpful for us to make it more clear if it's unclear. So thank you.
Thank you, Norway. With that, I think we can take a break. So you are aware, we've asked the board to come later to meet with us. So we will meet with them starting at 5:30. So between 5:30 and 6:30. So if we can be back in the room in 20 minutes, this means we will have an hour to prepare in a closed session for our meeting with the board. Okay? 20 minutes. Thank you.